Better to mock the game than to play and lose. Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones podcast. Founded in 2010 as Two Champs and a Chump, we decided it was time to rebrand and relaunch just in time for the game to do the same with its second edition. Tune in each week for your dose of strategy, discussion, jokes, and good old geek culture. Be sure to check www.whitebookpodcast.com for more content, generally in written form. Huge thanks go out to George R.R. Martin for creating this world, FFG for a great game, all of our contributors, and you, the listeners. Contact us on this site, facebook.com, as well as Twitter, or email contact@whitebookpodcast.com. This Creative Commons music is Townfish by Spinoza. Welcome back, folks, to what winds up being episode 256 now of the White Book Podcast. Whew, we are still just trucking along. The number just sounds so ludicrous to me for some reason. But
it's big.
Yeah, and it's good to get kind of back into a groove podcasting. I mean, I really enjoyed a little bit of time off, but nice to get back into the routine. Feel like we're making headway again. So, yeah, this week, obviously, you folks heard one of my co-hosts there. Why don't you introduce yourself?
Hey, Tommy from Chicago here.
And my other returning founder.
Yeah, this is Greg. Hi, Tommy. It's been a long time since we've been on.
I know, right? I feel like I've seen you more recently than I've casted with you.
I think that that's true.
Yeah, yeah. We set up this sweet team thing so we could trade off, give people breaks and whatnot, and inevitably everything degenerates, and we just go with the hosts that are free. So, sorry for the confusion there, listeners, in being a half-and-a-half episode. Of course, I'm Will. And we have a fourth voice with us that I'm sure you'll wind up hearing during the episode. Sean, why don't you introduce yourself? Tell folks where they might know you from.
Danger Zone! Oh, God, I'm sorry. That's too early. I panicked.
That's it. Episode's over. Time to go home, guys.
That was awesome.
So, I'm Sean. You probably don't know me. I'm not very outwardly active in this community, but it's possible that you may have come across the other thing I'm involved with. I help host Cardboard of the Rings, which is your biweekly podcast about the Lord of the Rings card game, which, if you didn't know, is a another living card game by Fantasy Flight Games. I've been playing Thrones very casually for a while and have started to get into it a little bit more deeply in the past year. So happy to be here.
Yeah, and one interesting little tidbit that Sean might have accidentally skipped over there. For any folks that remember me kind of talking about a little Lord of the Rings custom fan thing that I've done last year, the whole keeping count sort of multiplayer tournament system we'd worked out. I say we because Sean was my co-creator on that business.
So, yeah.
Gosh, it was right about this time last year, I guess, that we were talking about it on your show.
Man. It's true. It's true. The crossover is complete now. There's so much crossover potential, man.
There is. It's a little sad that it took us so long to, like, complete that.
I'll forgive it.
Okay. Well, let's get rolling with the episode. We'll delve more into Sean's philosophy here as we go. But first off, before we move into the meat of the episode, I want to hit on some news. We had some out today. It's going to be a little dated by the time this episode comes out because for the first time in possibly ever, we are recording a full week in advance. So props.
So in that case, would we call it olds?
Yes.
We'll go with it.
Olds. I'll take it. So in the olds today, we had information on the 2016 North American Championship prizes. Did you guys have the chance to take a peek at that article?
I did not.
I did.
Wow. So 50-50 here. Sean, did you look?
We'll go ahead and say I did.
All right. He's making things up. Obviously, the number of folks that didn't.
It's a true 50-50, like you said.
Yeah, okay, that's fair. I wasn't going to count myself. I was just questioning the co-hosts. But yeah, if we count...
Oh, you count. You count.
Well, as generally kind of moderating things, I didn't figure it was fair to really count myself. But, you know, in the event of creating a tie rather than breaking one, sure.
Oh, and honestly, I now pulling up the article, I have looked at it, so you don't even have to lie anymore.
See, there we go. But regardless, in case some listeners have forgotten, since this will be olds by the time we're talking about it and they're listening, we have some information here. One particular thing that jumped out to me that was in the main announcement article, not the the drill down for the throne specific stuff, is that the top four in these tournaments at Gen Con actually get to purchase a reserved seat at the World Championship, which I don't think we had known about that before, right? Like, we knew the winner, much like last year, if I recall, got a reserved seat and a bye, but did we know about the reserved seats for the rest of the top four?
No, I think that's new.
So really, it's just allowing you to bypass the line for getting into Worlds? Am
yes.
I understanding that correctly?
Well, not the line to actually get into the building. I think supposed to mean the line to purchase a ticket, which happened, let's see, by the time you become a top four at Gen Con, it will have happened roughly a month and a half prior to Gen
Con. Yeah. That's a weird prize to me because the people who already have a reserve seat, myself being one from being a former champion, I don't really care about that prize. And that's why I haven't even bought my ticket yet because I'm not required to yet. And I don't have to do that till after Gen Con. But someone who doesn't already have to have a reserve seat has probably already reserved it. So really it's for the select few people who didn't get into Worlds because they ran out of space. And I guess my question is, did we even encounter that scenario? Did they cut off registration and tell people no more?
I believe they did.
Okay.
Yeah. But which probably means they reserved these spots separately from those that
yes.
were on sale. But yes. How many folks...
I would also imagine this is a refund, right?
Yeah.
For anybody that pre...
That's what I was wondering. Like, it's almost bordering on a no prize. Like, odds are pretty decent that these top four are dedicated players that already purchased a ticket, right? So, do you get a refund? Like, are you winning $80 or whatever your entry and tournament wound up costing?
I don't think you're winning any money. It reserves the opportunity to buy a seat. It doesn't say you get a free entry into Worlds, correct?
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Point.
Yeah.
The wording is very much
so it's almost 100% not actually a prize is what I get out of this.
I wonder what stops them from...
Oh, Fantasy Flight, how close are they going to get to offering prizes that are just actually not prizes? They are toeing the line.
It's so close to being real. I wonder what stops them from... I mean, I know these things probably take lots of times to plan and they have limited resources, but I wonder what's stopping them from just doing registration, like even the week after Gen Con would be so much better for people trying to plan this out.
Yeah, especially if you're using these as prizes and stuff. I honestly don't know what is holding that up, unless it's something to do with blocking out hotels.
You got to wonder if when they change the structure, like what's coming next year, if they do change that timing.
Oh, with the split up from the Star Wars stuff?
Yeah. Because, I mean, you're going to have a smaller demand, so your time to react is, you know, it's relative to the amount of people that are participating.
Yeah, and hopefully as well, then it's less likely for servers to crash and the like. It'll be good.
That was a fun show.
It's a real thing, though.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go ahead and delve into the actual prizes for the Gen Con North American Championship, because I think there's a couple interesting tidbits in there as well. So,
and just so we're clear, the actual prize is not the almost prizes.
Well, people may have some opinions on some of these, but most of these are physical items. So, first place gets the first place trophy, which does appear to say North American Champion on it, and I believe does feature a different design than regionals. And you also get a first round bye for Worlds. Then the top four each receive a printed acrylic Iron Throne initiative token, an iconic symbol sure to hit the table every time. That was a verbatim quote. Then we've got the top eight.
You left off the parenthetical each of your demo games.
Well, we would have to have the demo decks we were promised a year ago to do that.
See how I set you up for that?
Yeah.
See how I set you up for that?
Exactly.
That was a beautiful underhand pitch.
Tommy's real good at playing softball. Okay, so top 16 get a set of acrylic gold tokens. The day two competitors, those that make it to the day two portion of graduated cut, will receive a brand new, never-before-seen plastic spot-glossed card that will be announced and revealed to the world at the beginning of the tournament. And then all competitors receive one copy of the alternate art card Forgotten Plans and one copy of a brand new extended art card debuted at the beginning of the tournament. So I think there's three things. I'm going to work my way backwards into this, but three things that seem interesting to me here. Two of them are connected here. The unannounced cards. Do you think that's because they're not done? Are they just trying to build some kind of extra like, hype to get people pumped? Or what? I'm a little confused there.
What's the only card that's going to psych you up to get an extra copy of in advance?
Like if I Forgotten knew plans. What it was?
Yeah. If you knew what it was.
Altered,
I mean, of all the cards that they've spoiled... Of all the cards that they've spoiled for upcoming cards, to get one in advance in full bleed art.
Oh, you're saying if it was unreleased?
Correct. Just like they've done with the Eyrie, etc.
Well, the Altar Varus was already out, but yeah, I mean, it would be Valor, of course. And that was
right.
The first promo card for first edition. Granted, we're kind of behind the times for first, but I mean, there's a precedent for using it.
And that's a prize, in my opinion.
Okay, what about this, then? They mentioned that it's a never-before-seen plastic spot-glossed card. Now, I want to break that down, because I'm not familiar with the term. Does that mean foil?
That sounds like foil, yeah, but it
sure does sound like that.
It... Spot gloss, though, is kind of like what you would see on a design on, like, maybe the front of a textbook where, you know, say you've got a picture of people and their silhouettes are all glossed, but the background is matte. That's spot gloss.
In effect, it creates some sort of different texture than what you're used to on a card, though.
Right.
Okay, interesting. Because I was about to say, would you be excited about a foil of Valor? But so spot glossing is a little different. When you mentioned the textbook, then I was suddenly, now I knew what you're talking about. What would actually look good like that? I feel like you would need something maybe fiery.
I was gonna gloss. Looks amazing with that. You know, if you had an alternate art Wildfire Assault, that's gonna look cool.
Oh, that'd be pretty sweet.
Maybe like Rhaegar and Robert on the Trident with the rubies all flying around so it sparkles.
Oh, dude, that would be sick. Or a crown of gold, yep, where the gold sparkles and glitters as it pours over Viserys' head.
Or Danny walking out of the pyre.
Yeah, there's a lot of sweet options here.
Naked.
Let's not go down that rabbit hole.
The sensor bars are
with a glossy Nate French head. And I think that ended.
That would actually be amazing.
Okay, well, on to my last observation, which I think is going to eventually lead into the segue here to the main topic. But I find the top four prize very interesting with the initiative token, because I really still never see anyone use it in Joust, the one included with the core set, I mean. Though I have heard some mumbling that it's pretty handy in Melee. From different people. So I find it interesting to see this mentioned here, because as far as I can tell from this announcement, unlike what we had seen originally for the Gen Con events, they appear to be saying that only Joust is the national, or sorry, the North American Continental Championship at Gen Con, and that Melee has been downgraded there now as well. So
that is not what the registration said, and I feel like if that is what they're going to do, they need to give people refunds.
That would be good. And you know, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but just the way this is phrased in general in the article, and the fact that only a Game of Thrones the card game is listed with no mention of the two different formats, just really makes me think that they're only talking Joust the whole time.
And I mean, how hard would it have been if that was the case for them to say, for both the Melee and Joust North American Championships, you will experience this array of prizes? Because generally, over the past couple of years, they've been identical prizes.
Exactly. And, you know, so there's still that out. They may still be doing both, and they just left it, you know, generic like this, because it's the same for both. I don't know.
Well, and it says the winner of a national championship. So was Origins a national again this year?
Origins was national. Yeah, technically, this is supposed to be continental for GenCon.
Well,
for Game of Thrones. So yeah, that's actually a really good point. Those are North American championship prizes. Does it say national anywhere? No, I keep seeing North American.
No, it's supposed to be continental. Origins was supposed to be the national, I believe. And it looks like the mats on the article say North American.
Right. Yeah. So, okay. Everything still seems to line up for continental.
But to his point, the fact that it says A, even if it is a North American championship, that does give you just that window of ambiguity that you won't get there. Yep.
And not to nitpick, but isn't it technically the first player token, not the initiative token?
Yeah, I think so.
Could you be more right?
Also, the one in the picture, now that you got me looking at it, is that actually just the one from the core set? And not like some neat acrylic thing?
It's more flary than the one from the corset.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's got
the blades are sticking out longer.
Yeah, rounded.
But that's all I got.
And you got a little silhouette of lamination around it.
Does it say it's acrylic? Because in the picture, it honestly looks a little cardboard.
Yeah, it says acrylic in the article. So that's part of why I was wondering when I looked at it. Like, wait a minute, is that the corset?
Suboptimal.
Hey guys, Will. You're about to notice something a little funny this episode. We seem to have somehow lost a large chunk of the first file of our recording. Unfortunately, that section contained our transition into talking more about Melee, talking a bit about how we feel FFG seems to be overlooking the game, and how we feel the community is failing as well, and how we could be taking a look at improving how things are handled. In a vastly simplified nutshell, I will just say that, yes, FFG seems to really be downgrading things lately, as evidenced by Origins, Gen Con, and Worlds in relation to Melee, which is very unfortunate. They have the only kind of customizable card game of this kind with a fully realized multiplayer format, and I really feel that they should be capitalizing on that rather than attempting to sweep it under the rug. From a community perspective, I find it unfortunate how many people deride it frequently because they personally don't enjoy it. I'm not someone who really frequents a lot of, say, sports forums or the like, but I think it would be odd to see the same amount of scorn heaped on an alternate format, like in a fantasy football league. Do you generally see people randomly in the middle, of an NFL discussion, or people who are NFL fans rather, randomly pointing out how much they hate Arena in someone else's thread about Arena football? I don't know. I don't go check it out, but I do think it's unfortunate the amount of time and effort that certain members of the community spend in putting down a format that they don't have to play and that a lot of other people do enjoy. Aside from that, we also hit on some strategy thoughts on sitting down at your first Melee table, a little bit of differences in kind of deck construction and mindset focus, some different thoughts in challenge priority, the importance of initiative. I really hope that we can get this crew back together again to tackle some of these things another time, particularly getting Sean on as a guest once again. One thing that I do specifically remember from that discussion that I want to take just a moment to impart to you, though, is that there's a different consideration that you need to think about if you're sitting down to a Melee and to help you get in the proper mindset to this, which is how much lower your odds are of winning at just base odds, considering all things are equal, no player skill, random crappy luck of the draw things. When you sit down to a joust, your odds are 50-50 that you win, right? I think we can all agree that. When you sit down at the ideal, i.e. four-player Melee table, those odds drop in half to 25%. You only have a quarter chance of winning that table. And I think that's something that trips up a lot of players who feel like they ought to stand as good a chance as they do in Joust to win that table. And it takes much more to skew that, right? In Joust, when you begin at 50-50, you know, play skill suddenly makes it 55-45, or, you know, luck of the draw suddenly flips it 51-49, whatever the numbers may work out to be on an individual basis. But basically, it takes much less to skew that versus Melee when you are trying to get up there above three other players in odds. And I think just accepting that and knowing it going in changes how you react to it and your consideration and how you handle the fact that you can't control your destiny as well as you can in Joust, and certainly not as well as you can in, say, a solo game like Lord of the Rings while we're at it. As well with the errors that we had with the episode this week and Gen Con coming up, I'd like to go ahead and debut a new product on the podcast website that I'll tell you about briefly here. I have commissioned art and layout on a set of seven custom art micro-sized card tokens for Game of Thrones, Poison, Stand, Betrayal, and Strength plus and minus 1 through 4. Those are going to be dual-sided with different art on both sides. You guys know I put quite a bit of expense into this podcast, and while there was a bit of an expense in getting this particular product up and going, I wanted to offer something of value to the community that you could purchase, that you could use in your games, that could be used. Then hopefully sales are good enough to recoup some costs and kind of hopefully set us on the right track toward covering everything we're doing and maybe getting some new headphones and such. Of course, as always, there is a donate option in the store as well, if you would rather donate that way. Or we may even consider doing a Patreon or something along those lines. So let me know. But regardless, I was able to get the latter half of the episode here to go with the beginning. So without further ado, the episode. When your enemies defy you, serve them
that's the one.
And fire. And for no particular reason, Chrome just scrolled to a different portion of the page. I didn't even have my hand on the mouse.
Oh, Chrome.
And when they go to their knees, however, you must help them back to their feet.
Nailed it.
Yep.
Nailed it.
Elsewise, no man will ever bend the knee to you.
Yep.
Yeah. So, anyway, slight connection there to that Tywin quote in my head. Just kind of thinking about it. You know, yes, you want to hit them, but don't want to hit people so hard that they're not still there to be an asset to you in the future.
It's a very valid point.
Also, you can just create hurt feelings at times, and someone might just spite you for the rest of the game. I've seen it happen.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's oh yeah. Absolutely.
You never want to convert someone into a Chella mid-game. Because
oh, and it's so easy when you're in fourth
place. It's really easy. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and I think that's another thing. People that aren't really into the Melee scene complain about how winning is out of their hands. And I think the base lower odds of winning plays into that, and I think that's something they don't consider enough. But as well, something that I think you have to watch so that you're not putting that decision making kind of capability, or at least so that you don't do that to someone else, is that you don't convert someone to a Chella mid-game. You don't push them so far down or knock them out of the game so that they feel they're not in it and they start making rational decisions or decisions that you can't have a reasonable chance of predicting and accounting for.
A lot of very new Melee players will look at it as, oh, if I eliminate a player entirely from contention, I'm helping myself. But they don't understand the implications of what they're doing.
Right. When you play something like Magic and you eliminate a player in multiplayer, they are out. Their decisions no longer have any impact in the game because they're not in the game. But in Thrones,
and they no longer
eliminate a player.
That's not true, Will. You can eliminate a player by milling their deck in Melee.
Okay.
That's the only way to eliminate.
That's
bring possible. Those loots.
We'll see when that actually happens. But in practical terms, you may eliminate them from contention, but they're still in the game with the opportunity to make decisions. And when you've eliminated someone's standard motivation in the game, well, now their decisions don't have the same goal anymore. And that's when it gets really awkward and
it's still very real life.
Oh, yeah, totally.
So in the context of Thrones, like the most dangerous thing about like eliminating someone from contention where they like say only have one or two characters is you just make them a target for unopposed challenges. Yeah. And that's the thing. Like that's what you have to keep in mind. Like I think, you know, unless you're playing against Greyjoy, unopposed power challenges or unopposed any challenges, it's not necessarily something you really think about until you are scared your opponent is going to close. But one of the things you'll learn about in Melee is people close really quickly. And the opportunity to just get a couple unopposed power off this person who, you know, was forced to kneel their board out and, you know, because someone was playing Stannis in Melee or something. And that's going to add up real quick.
Well, I think that's a really good way to segue into the different valuations that you apply in Melee versus some of the things that you look at in Joust. I mean, I think you apply a lot more value to initiative and to the ability to dump cards out quickly in a single turn than you do in a Joust game.
Absolutely. Initiative is so big in Melee. Being able to control the first player and where that goes. And, you know, we're getting back to maybe talking a little bit about your first time in a Melee tournament. Going first can be almost paralyzing for how complex the board states can be. Yeah. So being able to control initiative like that is so, so important.
In some ways, not just dictating first player, but dictating last player.
Right.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the buy rules that I was told by one of my mentors in Melee, which is Dan Struhal, is a general rule in Melee is you want to go last until you can win.
I stand by that.
That seems fair.
And because being the person, particularly when it comes to marshaling, it's very useful to sort of go third or fourth in a four-player Melee game.
And if you're going to try and do any sort of aspect of control in a Melee game, you have no alternative but to go last.
Also absolutely.
It works not only for control, but also better for rush. It's just better in almost all regards for control because other players will have committed to the board, so you can better judge where to use your effects. For aggro or rush because you can look for the weakest target. But on the flip side, not everything gets better at that point, right? I think we do have to acknowledge titles as another very unique portion of the Melee game. And if you want a specific one, or at least the best chance of it, since one is discarded randomly at the beginning, you may be looking at going first to nab it.
Well, and that's one of the other things relative to Roy's comment that I wanted to make sure that we touched on is that you want to go last unless you know you're going to be able to win or unless you need to prevent someone else from winning. Because obviously, if they're trying to win, they're going to want to go first and dictate the tempo.
Absolutely.
And you have to be cognizant of the players that even though they seem like they may not be in striking distance, you have to be able to predict what's in their hand, predict what they could potentially be doing to create an opportunity for themselves.
Another thing is you have like events that are less, or events and characters that are, say, less efficient in Joust see a lot more play in melee. So you have to, because people want to gain power quickly. Even if they're not a rush deck, even control decks in melee want to be able to gain power quickly, because since you have to play against the options of two to three other people, you want to be able to just shut that door real quick and end up on the other side with your opponents left in the dust. So events like Superior Claim, or characters like River Run Minstrel, or that upcoming plot, Winter Festival, those are the kind of, like, the ability to gain power rapidly or gain power outside of the challenges phase is at a massive premium in melee.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. Anything there like that, the surprise factor, you know, in many ways, it's all about not looking like a threat until you've already sealed the deal, which those surprise power gaining effects do for you. And I would argue that that feels very Nedly. That is to say, for anyone jumping in here, we've used the term a few times already at this point, but that is, it feels very thematic for the world of Westeros. Okay, so yeah, I think Tommy was kind of wanting to hit on some deck building differences and choices that really go into things here, and that connects pretty smoothly with what we had going on. So what were you looking at, Tommy?
Well, I think some of the comments that Roy made specifically when it comes to characters that may be specifically more efficient in melee versus a Joust situation, and some of the events that you may look at in a melee situation versus Joust. Outside of that, some of the other ways that you might construct a deck to create optimal situations for you, either to buy time for yourself, set up for yourself, or close for yourself in a melee game. I think there's a lot of deck construction differences that somebody that's not used to a competitive melee situation wouldn't necessarily find intuitive, if you know what I'm saying.
Absolutely. Like, well, go ahead.
Right.
Absolutely. Like, let's pick a practical card that, like Dragon's Tale, which is a card that came out in the most recent chapter pack that we reviewed in the last episode. Dragon's Tale is just not an efficient card in Joust, right? You are drawing cards, but you're also giving your only opponent cards, right? But Dragon's Tale is a very efficient card in melee. One, it's zero cost, so it's a surprise. It's a surprise way to fill your hand when opponents weren't necessarily expecting. And you get to choose the other player. So it makes friends. It's a card that makes friends for you. And only one other player is going to benefit. So you can pick a player who you can give the benefit to. Say you're in fourth and you give the player who's in third two cards. Or you need something from your opponents, and you can now have something you can trade. Be like, I need an unopposed intrigue challenge. If I give you two cards from your top of your deck, will you let me do that? Things like that. It just sort of creates opportunities that you can't really do in Joust. You can't say to your opponent, well, don't do a power intrigue challenge against me, and you know, I'll give you these two cards, because they have to draw these two cards in Joust. So that's a card that you would definitely stop and think, oh, that's much more efficient in melee than you ever would in Joust.
Well, and I think to that point, the way that you evaluate cards in melee versus Joust changes such that anything that's open-ended in melee is much more valuable than it is in Joust. For example, with the card that you just cited, right? You could look at it as a leveraging piece to say, hey, I know that you're down on cards and really need cards, so you're going to do this for me, and I'm going to give you two cards. And I'm going to pay nothing for it and still get two cards for myself. Or I'm going to say, hey, you're in fourth place and I'm in first place and I'm about to close this game. I'm going to pay zero cost for this event. I'm going to draw two cards, hopefully hitting on one of the events that I need to close this game down. Or I'm going to say, you're going to draw two cards and you're going to let me have one post challenge without them being aware of the fact that you're going to dump your superior claim on that unopposed challenge they just guaranteed you for nothing. So being able to utilize it in all those different areas, it's something you would never have the opportunity to even explore in a joust situation. Open-ended decision points are the key to a successful melee tournament, in my opinion.
I think another thing that you want to consider when you're looking at cards in Melee versus Joust is action. Do you, in Thrones, do we call it action advantage? That's what we call it in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. Thanks to listening to you guys, I've brought the term up a few times on our show because I like the concept a lot. And I think it applies much more in second edition with the emphasis on these large unit characters than it did in first. So, why don't you tell listeners what that concept is a little bit?
So the idea is that a dude you have on the board, by default, generally, has one action. They have one thing that you can do to turn them sideways, and that's what they do. But we obviously have many characters that have stand effects. We have characters that have not kneel effects. And that is action advantage over, you know, you're assuming what maybe your opponent has. But since there are more opponents, more challenges being thrown around, more options that become available to you, excess action advantage is way more valuable in Melee than it is in Joust. I don't know that I would play him over Fast Eddie, but before he came out, I think a lot of people pass over Corset Ned in Joust, but in Melee, he is super playable. It's the fact that there are way more challenges coming at you, and he will likely pop up every time. So things along those lines are really something to consider hard in Melee, because you leave yourself, like Tommy was saying, you leave yourself more options, to more decision points, and more opportunities to capitalize on opportunities that come up.
Cards that have open-ended triggering conditions, so like Funeral Pyre, which is in the last chapter pack of the first cycle, are really strong in Melee, right? That it's not just what one opponent's doing, it's what any opponent is doing, and any opponent can do commonly or easily. And so things like the Bone Way also, like the Bone Way has shown to be a pretty solid card in Joust, but it gets really strong in Melee because it's got a threat of activation, it can trigger off what any opponent does to you. It's just these cards that just are very open-ended and very difficult for opponent to easily play around, are just so, so much stronger in Melee.
I would agree with that. And, kind of playing along those same lines that you guys have been talking about, and scaling effects in general, I think, should be kind of hit on more specifically. Those that don't specifically mention you and one other single opponent, but ones that will hit everyone at the table, say March to the Wall or Naval Superior.
Even-handed Justice.
Yeah, Even-handed Justice. It's very easy to see then that their power is, multiplicative based on the opponents at the table, which is good. They are very powerful cards and continue to be very powerful, and in some ways become more powerful in Melee. But those, I think, are also the cards that you really need to watch, and because they're the ones most likely to generate maximum ill will with players. And while they give you huge payoff in the cardboard portion of the game, can really give you a negative payoff in the social portion of the game.
Well, and Will, I'm glad you mentioned March to the Wall, because that is a great example of a card that's going to give you a huge impact, but also give you that negative social aspect that you were talking about. But it's also a great example of a card that's giving you good effect as well as a large initiative number, which, we briefly initiative being so important. And if you're able to make a swing effect like that and claim initiative simultaneously, that's exactly the kind of thing that you can use to create a window that allows you to snatch victory.
You were about to...
No, I was just going to say March is just a dangerous card to play.
Gotcha.
Because it... So.
And I agree with that. I just was using that to try and get us into plots, but...
Yeah.
No, it was a good example. But maybe we should actually talk a little bit about plots more explicitly.
Yeah, that's all good.
Maybe.
Yeah.
One of you guys want to jump at the plots?
Yeah, I'll do it. I think I have a good way to build off what Tommy said about March.
Okay.
Awesome.
3, 2, 1.
Yeah, March is an interesting plot, Emily, because I think it's not necessarily one that comes out as it's like a straightforwardly excellent plot in Joust, and you see it in a lot of Joust decks. But in Melee, it's a little bit of a sort of like dangerous thing because it has that chance of creating opportunities where you make enemies, right? To give you the opponent who, say, his board is like John, Rob, Eddard, and he has to march one of these three characters, and he's like, oh, screw you, Tommy. I'm going to target you for the rest of the game if I'm given an opportunity. But you get plots that are sort of underrated in Joust become really, really, really strong, particularly ones that serve as closers. Like, for example, Rise of the Kraken, right? Which you do see in Greyjoy decks, particularly like the Greyjoy Crossing, but in other Greyjoy decks, it's fallen a little bit out of favor because of that low gold. But in Melee, that card is ridiculous. Just ridiculous. Not only does it have 2 claim, but it allows you to gain additional power more quickly, which we said is already really strong. So your plot game changes a lot in Melee. You have to just sort of think about what direction you want to take your deck in a way that is very different than in Joust.
One other thing that I'll mention that I think is interesting is you say how, you know, with a plot like Rise of the Kraken or the March to the Wall, you're getting that 8 initiative, you're getting a splash effect, you're getting good claim with the Rise of the Kraken, whatever. In Melee, your plots that aren't necessarily great in Joust also scale. Like the one that I'm thinking of specifically is Fortified Position, where you're only getting a 5-1-1, but your effect to the entire table is enormous because you're taking away all of the renown. You're taking away all the additional keywords, any stand effects. Like that is a turn that if you know that it's coming and you're prepared for it, you can capitalize on that swing and close on it. But your opponent, there's no way really for them to mitigate that.
And I think another big thing where your plot considerations are different from Joust to Melee is you tend not to see as many in a Melee game. So you I guess in a way kind of have a little bit more room to throw in the occasional what if low percentage plot, because chances are if the situation presents itself where it's useful, you'll have it. But you might not have that situation where it's a plot that you don't want it. it's that bomb waiting in your plot deck. You might not go 7 plots in Melee as it stands now. So you have a little bit more room there.
Yeah, that's
absolutely. Like flex plots are really, really, really key in Melee because the ability to have, like Tommy mentioned, like a fortified position in your plot deck that can be a, you know, shut down the renown that lets me close it out with my events, or shut down their renown and stall the game out for me to draw some answers is just so much more important than in like having answer plots, which was something very popular in 1.0 Joust. It's a lot less popular. But in Melee, it's really, really, really important in second edition.
Now, I'm just kind of curious, and this might be somewhat tangential. I've not actually played Melee in a meta where Valar exists. How does that affect the length of Melee games in general?
In first edition, where I continued to play Valar in essentially all of my Melee decks, I would say games still kind of averaged about 3 turns, which is closer or close-ish still to second edition. I feel like second edition started off a bit slower than first, but we've we've picked up a few cards that have sped it up since then.
Well, and Will, correct me if I'm wrong, I would feel like in Melee in 1.0, Valor almost was exclusively an aggressive play as opposed to an attempted comeback play.
Mostly I agree with that. And it definitely tended that way in the decks that I tended to play. But it could be maybe handy as a hot button against some really fast Cersei decks that were trying to take the game down in their challenges second turn.
But at that point, it becomes more risk mitigation than actually playing into your strategy when you built the deck.
Yeah.
Right. I don't know. In my experience in competitive Melee in first edition, and you guys played longer than me, but was there, you also always had to remember that if it was highly likely at least one player was going to Valor on the second turn. Like particularly if it was clear, because there was usually at most tables, and I still think this is true in second edition, there's usually about at least one rush deck that can theoretically win either sometimes in the first turn if like literally everything goes perfectly for them, or if they go first the second turn, they'll just win. And you'll see people Valor in that second turn. So you have to sort of remember that, which it was very uncommon in first edition Joust to see someone Valor on the second turn, particularly at highly competitive play. But in Melee, I saw that, I think, at almost every single table that I was at Worlds and Gen Con last year.
Oh, wow. That is quite a lot. Even a bit more than I was expecting.
I think that those are legitimate experiences that you had, and I think that they would, over the course of a large enough sample size, repeat themselves, but I don't think that is the common thing that most people would experience when they would sit down for a Melee.
Okay, so anything else pressing on plots there, or maybe should we talk for a brief moment about, well, frankly, talk?
Well, one of the most interesting things that we sort of been talking a little bit around at Highly Competitive Melee is before the cut, you can play for position, right? Which is that, you get points for coming in second, you coming in third. I don't believe you get any points for coming in fourth. So, the ability to position, all right, you clearly can't win the game, but cutting a deal with the first play, like the player who is going to win, that makes them win more quickly, but puts you in second, is a legitimate thing to do. The ability to talk your opponent. So even if you can't win that game, but to talk yourself into an excellent placement in the game opens up opportunities. So you could, for example, come in second at one table and win your next two tables and make the cut. And so just keeping that in mind and remember, like, where you end up, even if you don't win, is important. And it's sort of one of, I think it's actually the hardest Melee skill in my experience to successfully get a read on.
Yeah, and kind of switching from that binary mindset of Joust, like I win or I lose, it is an adjustment. You kind of have to keep in mind where you're sitting, who's going to close, do you have a chance at beating them to it? And yeah, I think that situational awareness in that case is super important.
Personally, in terms of table talk, I think the most valuable thing that you can do is, regardless of what your situation is, whether you're first at the table or you're last, whether you're about to lay the beat down and make the win, the push for the win, or you're trying to mount your comeback from the last position, table talking your opponent into allowing you to do what you want to do by only telling them what is available knowledge to them, reiterating what they could see if they were looking for it, telling no lies and pushing no agenda, but just simply reiterating fact in a way that advances where you're trying to be. If you're able to do that in a way that you can convince your audience that it's believable, I think you've halfway won your table.
And, you know, an interesting thing about the table talk and positioning and whatnot that I think is kind of unique to the Melee game, even in regards to other multiplayer games, is the way that your ability to leverage that shifts once you hit the cut in the tournament. Like Roy was saying about trying to maneuver yourself into a place where you can cut a deal for second if you don't foresee being able to seal the deal for a win and someone else can, you lose that capability in the cut portion of the tournament where only the winner proceeds. And I don't think that necessarily stops table talk, but it definitely hampers your tools, and it definitely makes everyone much more suspicious of what you're saying. Not that they're not suspicious to begin with. So in general, and even more so in the cut, I think it really behooves you to try to get yourself into each of your opponent's mindsets as you're watching things go at the table, not only to predict their moves so that you can try to compensate with your moves, but also to be able to suss out what their goal and what their plan is, so that when you try to make an argument to them, present an option, try to convince them, whatever it may be, that you're able to present it in terms that align with what you've determined their goals to be as best as possible, so that you can maximize the odds of them doing something, right? Make it look like it's the best deal for them. Even if it's not even necessarily a deal, like, you know, don't intrigue me and I won't military you or whatever. But make whatever you're trying to present look like it is in their best possible interest for the game plan that they currently have going.
Absolutely. And additionally, any gravitas that you have banked up over the course of pre-cut, where you're able to point back and say, hey, here's an example of where I held this deal. I never broke a deal at a single table. And if you happen to be so lucky to have somebody sitting at that table in the cut that could, you know, qualify that statement, whatever the case is, anytime that you're able to point back and say, I'm good for my word on this, you can guarantee it. This is the trend. Or I chose the same thing as what I'm trying to convince you of. Pointing to solid evidence is always an invaluable asset, I feel like. And whenever you're doing that on your own character and your own decision-making and your own ability to hold to deals that you made, you're going to put yourself in a position where you gain credibility, even in a situation where you're not necessarily somebody that should be given that credibility.
Okay, quick aside here from Will. And that's going to be that as much as I enjoyed us BSing and watching Space Stallions, I admit that was my fault. It also ate up my available time. So I unfortunately have to push us to go ahead and wrap this topic, despite there being quite a bit more I think we could talk about, and move props and flops and try to be done in the next handful of minutes.
Okie doke.
Let's Sean have one more swing at making some Melee comments before we move to props and slobs.
Nah, let's go to props and slobs.
You sure you don't have a parting thought on table talk?
No, not really. Not anything that hasn't already been said in some fashion.
Okay, fair enough. Well, I think for the moment then, that is going to table the Melee discussion for the episode. I think my co-host can vouch that we really only hit on the surface to middle layer of a lot of the stuff that we wanted to talk about. There's still a lot more we can discuss. I would especially like to get more in a future date into
table talk and kind of player psychology and different things, which I think would be a great episode in the future. But listeners, we'd love for you to kind of chime in on this discussion and see where it goes.
Props and slaps.
Woo. I want to go ahead and prop the Lord of the Rings, the card game, because it's an amazing card game. And Will, I'm so sad that the game or the episode that I finally came on for, Aaron's not here, because I was really gonna hard sell him on Lord of the Rings because he loves Sentinels so much.
I know.
So does he listen to episodes he's not on?
Sometimes. Yeah.
Okay, so Aaron, if you're listening, here.
Oh, Sean?
Sean just muted himself.
Whoops, I hit spacebar, my bad.
Oh, that auto mutes. Didn't actually realize that.
Yeah, nor I. All right. Okay, so Aaron, here's my hard sell on Lord of the Rings. You guys can back me up who have played it. Let me know if you think this is an apt comparison. So imagine a variant of Sentinels, where instead of a single hero, you get to pick three heroes, and then you get to build a custom deck from those heroes' decks. It's the simplest comparison I can make. It's way deeper than that, but there's no way that someone who loves the depth of a card game and likes Sentinels would not fall head over heels for Lord of the Rings.
I think you nailed it, and the one thing that I'll add to it that we've loved since we just recently started playing it, myself, my wife, and a couple of our friends, is that you've got all of that you just said, but then on top of it, you have ongoing story.
Yep. The narrative aspect of the game is insane.
And
also, let us not forget the absolutely gorgeous artwork.
There is that.
Like, it is across the board phenomenal. I mean, they really stepped up the Game of Thrones game, so to speak, for second edition in the artwork department. But Lord of the Rings has been and remains still head and shoulders above Thrones on that, I think.
Yeah, it's pretty killer. And you also are talking about a world-renowned IP versus an IP that was created for a game.
Definitely. And it's the perfect side game. There, I've gone to Worlds several times. Last year was the first time I actually competed in anything. Beyond that, I just play pickup games and I find other LCG players who also play Lord of the Rings and play side games of that. So if you're on the fence, you've thought about trying it, do it, because you will not regret it.
I play Lord of the Rings very casually and I have enjoyed it every single time I played it. So it's a good game. Very well designed.
That's my shameless plug for my other game.
Well, hilariously, that actually segues really well into a prop I had decided on much earlier. I know this is going to sound crazy, dear listeners, but it is actually a prop to FFG. And that prop is on having a game in an amazing state that plays multiplayer and also plays head-to-head. Head-to-head games are a dime a dozen, right, over the course of the whole kind of deck-constructing card game genre that Magic kind of kicked off. But the numbers of really solid multiplayer games, very, very small, let alone those that exist right now. So I want to prop FFG for having a phenomenal multiplayer card game, and then just say, hey, like, we've got this opportunity, guys. Capitalize on that.
Well said. So my prop was actually going to be, and ironically, I had no idea that our guest host this week is going to be a Lord of the Rings card game aficionado, if you will. But my prop was going to be for one of the upcoming Lord of the Rings products that FFG had announced. And in lieu of giving just my opinion, which means nothing since I'm new to Lord of the Rings, I'm going to ask what Sean has to say relative to the two new big boxes that they've announced. Which one are you more excited about?
Oh, God, that's tough. So for those who don't know, the Lord of the Rings game is split up into two product lines. One actually follows the course of the books. So you're actually going through Frodo's story. So related to that line, Flame of the West has just been announced. That follows basically everything that happens in Book One of Return of the King. So the Battle of Pelennor Fields, the Hold at the Black Gate, all those huge set piece moments. I'm more excited for that saga box than I've been for any of the saga expansions before. But the reason I got into Lord of the Rings is because I love to explore the unexplored corners of these big IPs. So I'm going to have to give it to the other product line at the moment that has its own story and narrative and is kind of all over Middle Earth, and it's Sands of Harad. So we're actually going to the home of the Sothrans, and we've got like wereworms and temperature mechanics to represent the heat of the desert. Oh, I mean, I if I had to pick a favorite, it would go to Sands of Harad, but it's just such a good time to be a Lord of the Rings player right now.
Well, you bastard, we are two peas in a pod, because that's the one that I'm most excited about as well. So
yes.
Make that three.
Here's hoping we get to ride Moomax. They've been punishing us in the game up to this point so badly, it only seems fair.
All right, Roy, you have anything to throw at us in the props and
flops realm? I have a positive, real-life prop. There's the word I'm looking for, which is the SEPTA customer service line, which when my girlfriend and I lost her bag today when we were switching trains between Philadelphia and New York, they were incredibly helpful to get everything sorted out for hopefully us to be able to get the bag properly tomorrow, and that was really great. I have a slop, though, and I think you guys talked about this earlier in the episode, but yeah, that Gen Con prize support announcement was terrible. It's terrible on a couple of levels. One, that it didn't list the number one prize that you get for winning Gen Con, which is a card design, which they later confirmed on social media. Two, they still have that terrible, terrible fucking Iron Throne token that, you know, when people who actually earned it showed pictures of it, it's just like, why the fuck do you want this? Like, why are you going to Gen Con to try to win this terrible Iron Throne first player token?
Initiative token. Gold
initiative token, right. And these gold tokens, like, one of the things you should have learned from Origins, and I understand, you know, product values and all this stuff, is just that the prize support has been very weak for the high-level competitive events this season, and that's really disappointing and really disconcerting for me. And this is someone who never in a million years expects to win a card design or, you know, maybe even, you know, or even make the top four at some event. But just the idea of really just not giving people the sort of quality merch that you should get from these sort of premier level tournaments that you can't play for other rewards is just really, really disappointing to me. And I was really upset when I saw that announcement today.
So, Roy, well, I couldn't agree with that statement anymore. The one thing that I'll have to take from it on a positive level is that we're talking about Gen Con, and as of today's recording, and for the listeners at home, we're recording on Wednesday the 20th. That puts us exactly two weeks from
2 weeks.
Gen Con. So there's a mega prop that it's 2 weeks away, people. And then you are all going to be in the shot. Here it comes.
A danger zone. I miss the old music. Also, cards that have open-ended trigger effects are also really, really, really strong. I almost think another card. Oh my god! The Targaryen zero cost event.
The funeral pyre.
Yeah, funeral pyre. Yeah, the one we just got. Funeral pyre. Yeah, I'll go back. My brain totally just completely farted on funeral pyre.
Oh, that's how that happens.
Yes, I farted on Khal Drogo's funeral pyre, but.
That sounds dangerous.
Well, the eggs needed the extra boost.
They did. They did. That smelly, smelly boost. Okay. Yeah, cards that have open... oh, man. Okay. Here we go. Sorry, Will.